welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom. I'm Christina Borgeson. Our guest today is arguably one of the best independent journalists out there, and certainly one of the best independent journalists working on the story of pedophile ringmaster Jeffrey Epstein and his sidekick, Ghislaine Maxwell, and their very mysterious, Epstein's very mysterious backer, Les Wexner. Most recently, Whitney, who, by the way, contributes to independent media outlets like Mint Press, Global Research, and EcoWatch, and is the winner of the 2019 Serena Shim Award for Uncompromised Integrity in Journalism. Whitney had a conversation with artist Maria Farmer, who was both an employee and victim, as well as her sister was a victim of Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. And this interview that she did, I mean, it just opened the window into the truly depraved and bizarre world of this most notorious pedophile in his social circle. Open that window up as wide as it has ever been open. That conversation, I mean, literally, it's so shocking, but Whitney got Farmer's permission on YouTube, and it's up there, and I have invited her on our show to talk about it because she's been covering Epstein for quite a bit, and Whitney has been doing amazing work on this. Welcome, Whitney.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, it's a real pleasure. And the first thing I'm going to ask you is to talk about the work you've done on this story and how Maria fits into it.
Right. Well, I did a four-part series back when I was writing for Mint Press News on the Jeffrey Epstein case, specifically focusing on his ties to intelligence and the history of sexual blackmail rings in the United States, specifically those tied to intelligence. I was interested actually in talking to Maria more recently. I recently obtained her contact information and reached out to her after this recent ruling out of Florida that basically says that the original deal negotiated when Epstein went to prison the first time stands, meaning that his co-conspirators like Ghislaine Maxwell, Leslie Wexner, and others will not be charged. So I was interested in reaching out to her to see her reaction or to, you know, get an idea of her reactions to those ruling and make that into a piece. And we just started talking, and immediately she just had so much information she wanted to get out that she had told me that she had told to every other, you know, journalist in the mainstream media that she had talked to previously, because she's done interviews, you know, with CBS and ABC and all of that. But told me that they maybe published like 5% of everything that she ended up telling them. And she just, I just honestly let her talk about everything. I published the first half thus far on YouTube of our call. It was over three hours. The first half of that call is now online. The second part will be going online next week. And for people that don't know, Maria Farmer is the first person who ever reported Epstein and Maxwell for their crimes against underage girls to the FBI all the way back in 1996, and the FBI did nothing. And she had a lot of information about the extent of the FBI's cover-up of, you know, Epstein's crimes going back to that period in time in 1996, you know, decades before he would actually end up going to prison the first time in what was, you know, is widely considered to be an unjust and very light sentence. So that's essentially where Maria fits in there and, you know, our conversations. And a lot of things she had to say corroborated things that I had heard from other individuals that I have interviewed, including a former Israeli military intelligence operative that met Epstein in the 1980s. And also information that came out from a former business partner of Epstein named Steve Hoffenberg, who was involved with Epstein and Tower Financial, who also corroborated, you know, his ties to various intelligence agencies, specifically Israel, though, of course, it's worth noting that Epstein and Wexner also had connections to U.S. intelligence.
So, first of all, let's just talk about Maria for a minute. She spent a year with them, right? And she was like an
That's correct.
She was allegedly, well, she was hired as an artist in residence, and she ended up being like the door person or something, or at the mansion, or the New York apartment, the infamous New York apartment. So she saw people coming and going there, right?
Right. She had graduated with a master's degree from the New York Academy of Art and had basically been working as a very underpaid, a domestic assistant, like a babysitter, basically, to Eileen Guggenheim, who was then the dean of that school, and was eventually pushed by Eileen Guggenheim and her sister into employment by Epstein, because from how Maria describes it, these Guggenheim sisters treated her so poorly that eventually she preferred, she was offered a job by Jeffrey Epstein. In retrospect, she believes it was kind of a setup to sort of get her pushed into Epstein's circle. But because of the situation she was in at the time, and because she needed money to, feed herself, pay back her loans and other things, she took the offer and tried to quit several times over the year she was there. But they kept telling her, oh, no, it's fine, we'll fix it. And were quite manipulative in keeping her from leaving. And then at some point, they convince her to take a job as being an artist in residence for the Wexners at their home in New Albany, Ohio, specifically because Leslie Wexner's wife, Abigail Wexner, wanted an artist in residence. And then she goes to stay in their guest house, where she, is not allowed to go outside without getting permission from them via phone first, and is given very little food. She lost, something like 20 pounds while she was there over this 3-month period. And Epstein and Maxwell would come to visit her in the Wexners about once a month. And on the third time that they had come, in this third month during her stay there, they attempted to sexually assault her. And what happened to Maria during that assault and afterwards is just honestly horrific. And it's really hard for me to really do it justice by describing it, secondhand. I would recommend that people listen to how she recounts that experience on the call. But she was very lucky to get out with her life. The reason she says she was able to escape is because she said that she had called on the landline of the guest house while she could, as many people as she knew, her entire family, all anyone's number that she had written down or could remember, to, raise hell essentially and tell everyone that she was at Wexner's and her life was being threatened and that she thought she was going to die. And they eventually let her go. But before that, before she called all these different, members of her family and friends and even acquaintances and things like that, she had tried to call the New Albany Sheriff's Department, and they told her to stop calling because it turns out that they also run private security on their off hours for Wexner's estate.
Yeah. And she talked about there being like dogs, like guard dogs to keep her from leaving, and sharpshooters. I'm telling you, that conversation lit my hair on fire. I mean, and then the other thing was her younger sister, Annie, right? 15 years old. Like, they got their clutches on her too, And could you talk about
that? Well, I'm not exactly familiar, because Maria and I didn't discuss it on this first call. We have a follow-up call planned in the near future about specifically how her sister got involved in this. But it was basically, from what Maria said, trying to groom her sister to be, a sex slave, essentially. But that hadn't happened at that point, because what Epstein did with a lot of his victims is that he promised them help with their education, or promise to, send them to various educational institutions and things like that. And he had done that with Annie Farmer, had sent her on some program, I believe, to Thailand or somewhere like that, and was in the process of attempting to groom her. And Ghislaine Maxwell told Maria that she was, they were planning to have her have Epstein's babies and stuff like that. I mean, really, disturbing things, because she was 15 at the time.
In her affidavit, the way she describes it was her sister was 15 and Maxwell and Epstein took an interest in her. And Epstein took us to a movie in New York. And during the movie, he held my younger sister's hand, was rubbing her in a sexual manner without my knowledge. He then contacted my mother and said he wanted to help put my younger sister through a special school program in Thailand. And then in summer 96, Epstein and Maxwell flew my younger sister to their ranch in New Mexico, and she was only 15. They directed her to take off all her clothes, get on a massage table. Maxwell and Epstein touched her inappropriately on the massage table, and she didn't learn about it until later. I mean, and then this whole thing about Ghislaine, I remember in the phone conversation, Ghislaine was saying, are you kidding? Jeffrey wants Annie to have his babies. I mean, that's like, you know, the God wanting to procreate with you or something. And that was very, very, very disturbing. What I was going to actually open the show with, I think, to me, it's just sounded like a sick fantasy when she was talking about being in a limo with Ivana Trump and Ghislaine Maxwell trolling the streets of, I guess, New York, right? Near the schools for young girls to recruit for Epstein, telling them that they were going to be Victoria's Secret models. Of course, Les Wexner owns Victoria's Secret. But anyway, that they were going to be Victoria's Secret models. And, you know, they'd get these kids' numbers, and then the kids would show up, you know, at his apartment, right? And and I think that the one, like the cry from the heart when she was telling you this, and I could tell that you were just, you know, frozen in shock. And I was too, when she said, I literally saw thousands of these girls, that five a day.
Right.
For years. So, I mean, I just, you know, it's just crazy. So, but, you know, like she was Ivana Trump. That is so bizarre. Anyway, could you talk about what you have found out? Because, you know, obviously Prince Andrew is in some hot water and he's trying very hard to pretend he's not. could you talk about what people don't know and that she revealed in that that interview about how far back and with many of these royals Epstein and Ghislaine go?
Right. Well, Prince Andrew is just one of these relationships where the mainstream narrative places the date of, you know, of him meeting Epstein much, much, much later than it when it really happened. And that's even true for Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell themselves. You know, the official narrative is they met in 1991. There are numerous accounts that they met much earlier, at least in the 1980s, and were dating at that point. Not by 1991. By all appearances, 1991 is when this sexual blackmail operation run essentially by the two of them began. But at any rate, Prince Andrew and Ghislaine Maxwell, according to Maria Farmer, grew up together, and she saw photographic evidence of this, of them being together as young teens and photo albums that Ghislaine Maxwell had and had shown to Maria Farmer. Of course, you know, she was Ghislaine Maxwell because of her father, Robert Maxwell, who was, you know, a wealthy media baron, among many other things, in the United Kingdom, you know, was definitely part of these elite circles. And Ghislaine Maxwell had been friends with Prince Andrew's, very close friends with Prince Andrew's ex-wife, Fergie, for a very long time. But apparently, you know, those ties at least go back to some point in the 70s. I mean, exact date is not known in terms of Maxwell and Prince Andrew. But I mean, given that they were in these pictures together around that age, you know, we can make some assumptions on dates there. But at any rate, it's definitely not in the 1990s. As has been claimed officially. And it's very likely then that since in the 1980s, Epstein was spending a lot of time in London, was seen coming in and out of Robert Maxwell's office with relative frequency, was dating Ghislaine Maxwell around this time. It's very likely that Epstein and Prince Andrew met in the same period of time as well. And that was what Maria understood based on her observations why she was there is that these, that they had known each other much longer than has been officially stated. And there's, you know, several other figures as well that have attempted to hide the extent, at least in terms of the length of their relationships with Epstein. Another person like that would actually be Bill Gates, who the New York Times claims only met Epstein for the first time in 2011. But actually, there's a Evening Standard article from 2001 that talks about Epstein and Gates having had by that time extensive business links, and actually says that Epstein's, you know, closest business links at the time of the publication of that article in 2001 were Leslie Wexner, Donald Trump, and Bill Gates. So obviously there is some there is a major effort there to cover up those Epstein Gate ties. And, you know, there's a lot of other figures, of course, that are trying to distance themselves or rewrite the narrative regarding their relationship with Epstein. That is something even Leslie Wexner has done. But in terms of the Prince Andrew relationship specifically, if you look at a lot of these very early reports in UK media, mainly from the year 2000 and things like this, it talks about how Prince Andrew would take his own personal massage table on vacations with Epstein, and, you know, vacationed with them on a very frequent basis for multiple weeks, several times a year, even brought invited Epstein as a guest to the Queen's birthday celebration. I mean, definitely the relationship was much more extensive than they, you know, even mainstream media is claiming at the current moment.
Well, I mean, mainstream media, come on, nobody's gonna accuse them.
Well, you'd be surprised. There's still some people that,
I mean,
you know,
she had that horrific experience with Vicky Ward of Vanity Fair. Could you talk about that? I mean, this is mainstream media, and you know, just talk
absolutely.
About it.
So Vicky Ward, especially after Epstein's second arrest last July, received a lot of accolades for her early on reporting on Epstein, specifically for Vanity Fair in the early 2000s, several years before his first arrest. Vicky Ward, in researching that reporting, had gotten in touch with the Farmer Sisters, had told the Farmer Sisters that she would, you know, protect their story. They told her lots of information in confidence. But Vicky Ward apparently considers herself to be of the elite, and ended up becoming friends with Ghislaine Maxwell, even after hearing from Maria and Annie, you know, the extent of Ghislaine Maxwell's crimes against them and other underage girls. And it's frankly very sickening, especially when you consider that it was Vicky Ward that ended up telling Ghislaine Maxwell that it had been Maria Farmer who had reported Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein, who, you know, are linked to intelligence and just, you know, considered to be dangerous individuals, had told them or told Maxwell that it had been Maria that had reported them, you know, putting Maria's life in direct danger, which is just the grossest violation of journalistic ethics I think I have honestly ever heard. And the fact that, you know, Vicky Ward is still held in high esteem by a lot of people for her Epstein reporting, I just think is absolutely egregious, and she needs to be held accountable for what she did to the Farmer Sisters, because it's frankly it's very disturbing, because, you know, Ghislaine Maxwell had even before then sent death threats to Maria Farmer, and, you know, knowing that she was the one that had tried to turn them in first years prior to the FBI, you know, put even more of a target on her back. So Vicky Ward essentially put a source whose story she had promised to, you know, maintain in confidence, tells her abuser that it had been, you know, tattles on her essentially to her abuser. I mean, it is just, it's sick. I honestly can't think of any other word to describe it. Just disturbing on multiple levels.
So where the hell, Whitney, is law enforcement and the justice system on this thing? What the hell is going on?
Well, it makes sense a little bit. Well, there's a couple different ways to make sense of this. First off, when you consider that Maria Farmer attempted to report Epstein and Maxwell to the FBI in 1996, at that time, the director of the FBI was a man named Louis Free. Louis Free, after leaving the FBI in the early 2000s, was later hired by Alan Dershowitz, a friend of Epstein, to harass Epstein victims and keep them from coming forward. By the way, Dershowitz was also one of the lawyers defending Epstein after his during his first arrest, right? Louis Free also ran cover for the Penn State molestation scandal. Involving, I think his name is Martin Sandusky. Free was also, a quote unquote independent investigator on that case and ended up, running interference and covering that up as well. So the fact that he was, FBI at the time, Maria, or FBI director at the time, Maria tried to report these individuals, I mean, it makes sense. But it also makes sense if you look at the larger history of the FBI and sexual blackmail operations, especially as I reported in my Epstein series, the first director of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, was involved in a sexual blackmail operation involving Roy Cohn and Louis Rosenstiel, both figures, both of those other figures closely tied to organized crime. And there's a lot of indications that that is why Hoover deliberately ignored organized crime for most of his career as FBI director. And so a lot of this type of activity, because the FBI was, involved in it historically to an extent that is, on historical record, but not talked about often, offers an explanation as to why they wouldn't be very interested in pursuing these types of operations when they're linked to the same intelligence, community of the FBI, the U.S., because the FBI is a domestic intelligence agency on one level, right? Not just law enforcement. And, as I mentioned earlier, Epstein had ties to the U.S. intelligence community as well as this organized crime apparatus that was responsible for that same sexual blackmail operation that had involved Hoover decades prior.
So there was one heroine in the FBI story, this woman Nesbitt, I believe her name is, right? Mm-hmm. Could you talk about her and what happened?
Well, from what Maria said, this woman who was fought very hard for her and for other victims and wanted to take down Epstein was eventually reassigned and taken off the case. And Maria believes she was placed in witness protection. But beyond that, I don't have a lot of information on this, on her specifically, because a lot of my reporting focuses on Epstein up until, the early 2000s, doesn't really go into the investigations into him in depth. I focus more on his intelligence ties and his network.
And so his whole purpose, I mean, first of all, let's be real clear about something. I think I've gathered from what Maria has said and what you've reported that Les Wexner is, might even be a higher level player in this than Epstein. Is that correct?
Yes, I would believe so. Yeah. I think that Epstein was just a project manager, and that Wexner was much more involved, higher up in the pecking order, as it were, of the entity ultimately responsible for that, for Epstein's operation. And Maria Farmer, and I believe that before I spoke to Maria Farmer, but Maria Farmer, when she reported Epstein and Maxwell to the FBI, also said, also named Leslie Wexner and referred to him as, quote, the head of the snake, because she was also under the impression that he was, essentially the brains of the of this whole network based on her experience there. And she had seen Maxwell and Epstein receive what she described as orders from Wexner, which they would, act upon after receiving them.
All his properties had these pinhole cameras, apparently. I mean, even the
yes.
one, like she was in a guest house, which was, I can't remember if it was in front or behind this big Wexner estate. 330 some odd acres, in the middle of 330 some odd acres. That was where she was doing this art project, right? And she was told by a maid that there was some kind of tunnel from her place to the bigger mansion, where after you go through the tunnel, a floor, an entire 10,000 square foot floor comes up so that nobody knows that you've come or gone. I mean, it's almost like fantasy when you read this stuff.
Yeah.
The evil, the reptilian aspect of it. Who is Wexner doing all this for?
Well, the answer to that is, of course, very hard to know, but there are some, if you look into Wexner's past, into some of his associations, you know, there are some clues. From what we know, right, about what Epstein was doing specifically, it appeared to have ties to Israeli military intelligence. And so people have argued that, you know, this was exclusively an Israeli intelligence operation. But I think, honestly, that's only part of the story, because if you look into Wexner, in 1985, there was a murder in Columbus, Ohio, of this lawyer named Arthur Shapiro, who at the time was representing one of Wexner's companies. And the results of the investigation into that homicide were covered up, essentially, because the police chief at the time said that the conclusions were potentially libelous to powerful Ohio businessmen. Yeah. Uh-huh. A couple of decades later, that report by accident comes out, and it details basically a structure of a criminal enterprise headed by Wexner with ties to what is called the National Crime Syndicate, which goes back to the 1920s and was really the marrying of the Jewish mob and the Italian mafia. And that same group was Louis Rosenstiel and Roy Cohn, who ran that sexual blackmail operation in which Hoover was involved. It's that same group that Wexner was also connected to, but decades later. And Wexner in 1991 with Charles Bronfman, the Bronfmans also have ties going back as a family, going back to the early 20th century with this National Crime Syndicate as well. The Bronfmans and Wexner together found an organization that's quote unquote philanthropic in nature, so they say, called the Mega Group.
Yeah. What about that group?
Well, if you look at the membership of the Mega Group as disclosed in this 1998 article in the Wall Street Journal, if you look into the history of the different individuals there, you will find a common thread being a direct association, whether through family or business activities, with the National Crime Syndicate or its affiliates. Okay. So, So essentially, I would argue that those were Epstein's real employers, because these are, everyone in the Mega Group is essentially a multimillionaire or a billionaire. A lot of them bankroll politicians, both in the U.S. and Israel. So I think, in my opinion, this group of, I guess I would describe them as transnational oligarchs, I would argue that they're Epstein's real employer and the real beneficiaries of this intelligence operation, because, you know, even if this was a Israeli military intelligence operation, you know, that ultimately would answer to politicians that were elected, and financed in large part by mega group donors. You know, as an example, Netanyahu, his first prime minister win in 1996 was largely bankrolled by Ronald Lauder, someone very close to Roy Cohn, very involved in these swamps of Manhattan in which Epstein swam, close to Wexner as well, and one of these mega group billionaires, right? So definitely has a lot of political influence there, and he's also a major political donor in the U.S., right? So I would essentially argue that, you know, saying that it was just Israeli military intelligence or, you know, another intelligence agency like U.S. intelligence sort of misses the bigger picture, which is that if you look at Wexner and his connections to a group like this with major political influence in both countries, it definitely seems like this is really where the root of this operation comes from.
Well, yeah, I mean, the intelligence operations of CIA and the intel operations of most countries do serve the power, normally, you know, for the most part, let's put it that way, serve the powerful business interests. They serve powerful business interests. I mean, the CIA, I mean, if you were to track the CIA all over the world, and I was reared in Haiti, I saw it firsthand, you know, that's what you see. It's promoting business interests and gathering intel through those businesses too. So,
right. Well, it's worth pointing out that both Israeli intelligence, the Mossad specifically, and the CIA have direct ties to the same national crime syndicate as well. So as an example, the forerunner to the CIA, the Office of Strategic Services, in what is now known as Operation Underworld, made a formal alliance, allegedly out of wartime necessity during World War II, with the National Crime Syndicate. And after the formation of the CIA, that alliance continued, and a lot of National Crime Syndicate members were on CIA assassination teams and also very involved in efforts to overthrow the Cuban government. And then on the other side of that, a lot of the Jewish American members of the National Crime Syndicate prior to the founding of the State of Israel were very involved in both financing and arms trafficking to Zionist paramilitaries that ended up creating the State of Israel, including Irgun, which at the time was led by Menachem Begin, and Begin later went on to found the Likud party, right? So a lot of these same groups have ties that go back decades and decades. And I would argue that what we're seeing with Epstein is just an iteration of that, because this sexual blackmail technique was not, this type of operation, you know, precedes, these intelligence agencies. It was first really used to great effect by organized crime. And later, you know, a lot of these intelligence agencies, as I just detailed, became allied with organized crime and essentially became massive organized criminal enterprises themselves, you know, like the CIA, for example, very involved in illegal gun running, drug trafficking, sex trafficking, I mean, you name it. So they essentially, you know, are cartels in their own sense, but are state sponsored. And of course, Epstein, I think, is no different, because there clearly was some sort of state sponsor involved there to some extent. And definitely intelligence, both in the U.S. and Israel, were very aware of what he was doing, definitely in the 90s, if not before.
I got to tell you, Whitney, I think you cracked the code. I swear to God, I mean, you've just put all the dots together. I don't think anybody's ever done that with this. And the larger picture, which is why it's so hard to get it addressed in any court, you know, anywhere. I mean, these crimes are like, are they crimes that are too big to prosecute? I mean,
I think what the issue is that when you start pulling on this thread, for example, you know, like the Epstein case, it starts to unravel a much bigger picture, I guess you could say, because a lot of the people involved, with Epstein, for example, in the 1980s, I mean, were tied into things like Iran-Contra, right? Which opens up a whole nother can of worms. So a lot of people involved in those types of activities, are either still in power, like William Barr, for example, a holdover from that era, among others. It's just, it starts to unravel a lot more of what's going on in the U.S. today and a lot of other scandals, and also the extent of these types of sexual blackmail operations in the past, because Epstein is just one example of sexual blackmail operations that involved pedophilia and the trafficking of children in the United States that were connected to intelligence or connected to very powerful political figures. And a lot of those past cases have been covered up very successfully. The Franklin scandal being one, a major one. But there are definitely more.
There are. What other big ones have you heard of or do you know of?
Well, there are some that were related to the Franklin scandal that were run out of Washington, D.C. by a guy named Craig Spence. It was actually investigation into Spence that led people to Larry King, who was running the Franklin scandal operation. Craig Spence was involved in, was doing the, doing this in Washington, D.C. He had ties to the CIA, and he actually took underage boys into the White House after hours on what were called midnight tours of the White House.
Yes.
Allegedly was allowed in by then National Security Advisor to George Bush Sr., who had previously been CIA director, Donald Gregg. Right. So definitely a lot of high powered people involved. In that specifically. And, you know, even in the 70s too, there was a high-powered PR executive named Robert Keith Gray that also did sexual blackmail for the CIA. He was also involved in the first, Ronald Reagan's first presidential campaign alongside people like William Casey. And, of course, as I mentioned earlier, Roy Cohn, who was involved with that core operation that I described earlier with Lewis Rosenstiel, and Hoover, he continued that type of operation well into the 1980s and was doing this in the 60s and the 70s, as well as the 1950s when he was McCarthy's right-hand man. A lot of that sexual, the sexual blackmail targets of that group, of that triad, I guess you could say at the time, were people, what was related to increasing the power of the McCarthyites, I guess you could say. So it's, you know, and Roy Cohn was involved in that type of stuff for decades. And, you know, there's a lot of hidden history there. And even now, you know, with Roy Cohn, mainstream media will report on him because he was Donald Trump's mentor.
Well,
and
I ask you, he was his mentor and his lawyer. And I was just curious to know what business you think Trump and Epstein were doing together.
Oh, I think it had to do with money laundering and real estate. I think given that Donald Trump was mentored by someone who was an expert sexual blackmailer, I think it was very unlikely that Trump got wrapped up in blackmail with Epstein unless he, you know, had already been blackmailed well before Epstein started doing that type of activity with some sort of affiliated group. But from what I understand, and I'll be putting this in my book, Wexner and Epstein in the 1980s were very involved in a lot of shady real estate purchases, and actually a lot of articles from the year 2000 and before that reference Epstein. They don't call him a billionaire or a hedge fund manager. They call him a property developer, and that's because he was very involved in real estate. But if you look at the real estate transactions he was connected to, it was passing a bunch of properties around to different shell companies for like a dollar. And things like that. And, you know, that is a pretty clear indication of money laundering, among other things. And, you know, like I was saying earlier, Epstein or Wexner's tax attorney was murdered, and he was after he right before he was murdered, he was set to do to testify on tax evasion, money laundering and tax shelters and things like this related to Wexner's business interests, right? So it would make sense. And also we know that, you know, Trump has been accused of money laundering with real estate and things like that. And actually the Epstein-Trump relationship ended up falling apart over a real estate deal involving a mansion in Palm Beach that Epstein had wanted to purchase. And then he brought Trump to come with him and look at it. And then Trump bought it out from under Epstein, and then flipped it over to an oligarch, I believe, from Russia, who actually never lived in the house, but paid an exorbitant sum for it, and then ended up, I think, demolishing the house.
Oh my God!
It was a very suspect transaction, right? So it definitely seems like this is the type of activity they were involved with together. And you know, Epstein and Trump partied frequently together at the 1980s, and they were also joined by another individual who's influential in the Trump administration today, named Tom Barrack, who's the head of Colony Capital, who was also involved a lot with New York real estate and a lot of shady real estate deals.
Oh my God, it's just, so let me ask you something. I mean, Les Wexner, he just doesn't even seem to be on the FBI's radar at all.
I mean, he should be, but there's a reason He's not. And it's because he's a very powerful individual and has a lot of ties to a lot of people who, you know, if they were to take him down, it would air out just so much dirty laundry, not just of the billionaire class in the US, but also intelligence. Because one thing about Wexner's past that just mainstream media has refused to touch, but it's documented, is that in 1995, Wexner and Epstein negotiated the relocation of Southern Air Transport from Miami, Florida to Columbus, Ohio, to exclusively run cargo for Wexner's company, The Limited, between Ohio and Hong Kong. Okay. And Southern Air Transport at the time was known as a CIA front company. It was actually the same airline that was involved in Iran-Contra drug trafficking. Prior to that, was known as Air America, was involved in drug trafficking in the Golden Triangle and in Southeast Asia when George Bush Sr. was CIA director and before. And in 1995, it was owned by a very spooky former CIA lawyer during the time of its relocation to Columbus, Ohio. And they were running cargo exclusively for Wexner and Epstein, right?
Wow.
And Ohio's inspector general at the time called it the Mayor Lansky run. And actually, Mayor Lansky is the guy that founded the National Crime Syndicate in the 1920s. So apparently this inspector general knew that there was some shady activity going on there and suspected that Wexner and Epstein were involved in trafficking of something with the CIA and, you know, organized crime, since Wexner's ties to organized crime were, you know, at least known to, you know, people like the inspector general at the time, even though it didn't come out, you know, in the public until a few years after that.
Well, he sure knew it was above his pay grade to even go there.
yeah.
You know, well, I mean, see, this is the thing I'm trying to figure out, is how is this thing going to be? Is it possible to chip away at this thing and break it open and lay it bare and make it, you know, and bring accountability? I mean, I noticed that today there have been a couple of reports. The former Palm Beach police officer, Mark Dugan, who released a from, you know, he has all the, could you talk about him? Tell our, you know, more the better than I do what's going on. You tell our listeners about him and what he's done recently.
Right. He's a former police officer in Palm Beach that had, you know, involvement in Epstein investigations. He claims to have taken, he currently says he only possesses 7 videos now, but he used to claim to have hundreds, but videos of people that have been blackmailed by Jeffrey Epstein, you know, videos of the rape of these underage girls by very powerful individuals. And he, I don't know if it was today or yesterday, but he released a still, what he says is a still photograph taken from one of these videos that shows the former CEO of Disney, Steve Burke, you know, involved in this illegal activity with an underage girl. And this is interesting, though I can't confirm its veracity, obviously, but it definitely has generated some buzz. But it's worth pointing out that Disney is also the owner of ABC News, and there was a leaked video that came out some time ago of Amy Robach of ABC News saying that the story had been killed by her superiors, or her reporting on the Epstein story that she was going to do a few years ago. The whole report was essentially shut down by her superiors at ABC News. So it's worth pointing out that the CEO of ABC News parent company, you know, is the person that Dugan is claiming with this photo of having been blackmailed by Epstein.
So he was a senior exec. He was also was or is a senior executive VP of Comcast and NBC Universal. He was.
He was CEO of Disney, but I believe he stepped down. I don't think he's still there, but I don't know where he is now. If he is at NBC Universal, that would be interesting.
He's a senior executive VP of Comcast and NBC Universal. So did you look at the still? I looked at the
still. I've seen the picture, yeah, the side by side.
Yeah, so it's a white guy naked, or at least didn't have a shirt on. That much you can tell. Very, you know, his hair very nicely cut, and very similarly cut to Steve Burke's hair. So, you know, but it's just kind of chilling in a way to look at that, because it sort of brings the immediacy of this thing. And, you know, that's another thing about this amazing interview that you did that people have got to go look at on YouTube, is the immediacy of the anecdotes that she provides. I mean, she talked about this, because I thought this was kind of both funny and just disgusting. The chef Andy, the famous chef who worked for them for 10 years, for Ghislaine and Jeffrey, and she said, if you want to talk to somebody who really knows who was there and who did what, you got to talk to the chef Andy. And she was describing what it was like when Bill Clinton would be coming into to the apartment, and she'd say that Glenn would be running around, you know, going, "Oh, the president is coming! The president's coming!" And she says, "Got to get lots of girls today. The president's coming." And this is when he was a sitting president.
Yeah.
So
absolutely. I am amazed that claim by Maria was just glossed over without any sort of future, without any, I don't know. I'm most shocked that they would not want to touch that, because it's just huge, honestly. Frankly, a lot of another one of these relationships, like I was mentioning earlier with Prince Andrew, like Prince Andrew and Bill Gates and all of that, that have close ties to Epstein, right, is Bill Clinton. And of course, the official narrative is that it wasn't until after he left office that there was a relationship with Epstein. But as Maria points out, this was not true. There is lots of corroborating evidence for what Maria says, in the sense that the Epstein, that Clinton was actually a major focus of the Epstein op, as well as people in Clinton's cabinet, including Bill Richardson, during the 1990s. And pretty much as soon as Clinton was in office, in 1993, you have Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell attending very high, very influential donor functions. You have in 1993, Epstein also visiting the White House on at least three occasions, meeting with the deputy chief of staff. In 1995, Epstein also at the time was very, very close to someone who was still a very powerful donor to the Clinton family, Lynn Forrester, who is now Lynn Forrester de Rothschild. But at the time, she hadn't married into the de Rothschild family yet. And in the early 90s, she divorced from a man named Andrew Stein, who was actually related through marriage to Louis Rosenstiel. And she had asked Epstein for unspecified assistance with her divorce. And by 1995, in a letter that is, part of the Clinton Presidential Library, actually, she talks about how she had seen Clinton at then-Senator Ted Kennedy's house. And because, you know, he's the president and a very busy man, she had only had a short amount of time, which she calls her 15 seconds of access, to talk to Bill Clinton. And what she says she discussed during that short period of time with the president was Jeffrey Epstein and currency stabilization.
Oh, wow.
And this is in 1995. And, you know, Lynn Forrester is, you know, one of the Clintons' most influential donors and someone very close to them. So for her to be talking directly to the president in 1995 about Epstein is very significant. And of course, that's the same year that Maria is saying that he, on, I think she said, three occasions that he was, you know, had visited the premises of, you know, an Epstein residence, and
no,
there were these party preparations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's saying no security detail. The only people there were two Filipino maids and Chef Andy. So she says Chef Andy has quite, and apparently he wasn't the most savory character either.
No, he was not. But actually, I don't know if you saw this, because it was on, I put it out on Twitter, I did not write an article about it, but unbeknownst to Maria, about a week before our call, and by the way, in the call, she talks about how she's trying to get her lawyers to subpoena the Chef Andy character.
Right.
For information, but actually a week before our call, Chef Andy, whose real name is Andy Stewart, was found suddenly dead at home. So he is not around anymore. And you know, his death is certainly eyebrow raising, considering what Maria Farmer had to say about him, calling him the quote unquote holy grail of information on the Epstein case.
Oh my God. Oh my God. You know, it's so interesting how they tried to contain, you know, on the Clinton side, they tried to contain the story when there were all those, you know, there were on the plane logs, there were all those entries where it showed that Clinton was on the plane. And so, you know,
right.
They say, well, yeah, he hitched a ride, you know, over here, over there, but he really wasn't, you know, like he really wasn't. So really wasn't socializing, as it were, or partaking or whatever, you know.
Well, he's officially on the flight logs over 20 times,
right?
With his name down there as Bill Clinton. But actually, Bill Clinton, when he would travel places without his security detail, sometimes would write down not his name, but the name of Doug Band, who's, you know, a longtime Clinton family associate, right? So it's very possible that all the times where Doug Band appears on the flight log of Epstein's plane, which is numerous occasions as well, it's very possible, as some have pointed out, that could also have been Bill Clinton, or it could have just been Doug Band since they had ties together. And it was actually through Doug Band that Bill Clinton obtained Epstein's jet for this AIDS fundraiser, supposedly, to Africa, that involved people like Kevin Spacey, who of course has been accused of, you know, sexual assault, as well as Ron Burkle, who's another billionaire that's accused of having partaken in illegal sexual activities, or at least of hiring, you know, a litany of prostitutes over the years. Of course, all of this came out after, in the years after that fundraiser. Initially, it was just reported on as, oh, wow, look at this. What a great fundraiser, you know. But over time, a lot of the people that were on that flight have been accused of sexual assault and other you know, shady activities.
You know, I wondered, do you fear for Maria's safety?
Well, Maria is definitely concerned, especially after what happened with the chef, Chef Andy. But honestly, the best thing that Maria can do is to be vocal about what's going on, because the more visible she is, the safer she is. And I think, you know, anyone listening to this, that wants to help Maria out should help amplify her story, because the more people that know that she's speaking up about this case, you know, the safer she is. If she was not speaking out and had faded into, you know, relative obscurity, for example, I think she would be in much more danger than she is if she's in full public view.
Could you, first of all, tell the audience where they can look, they can listen to your phone conversation with her, and where they can, you know, check out your reporting on other stuff too, because let's face it, Whitney, you're in a very small group of great journalists. So let them know where they
Thank
can.
You.
How can they watch, where can they go to watch this, this conversation, first of all?
Okay, so only the first half of the call is online. It is on the YouTube channel of the site I work for now, which is called The Last American Vagabond. So you type that into YouTube or BitChute or any other video platform like that, you will be able to find it that way. As I said earlier, the second half of that call will be coming out next week. My investigative work to date on Epstein was published at my previous employer that I left in March, Mint Press News. So if you go to Mint Press News and you look up Mint Press News Epstein investigation, my work on the case should come up there. But my current articles, all my current articles and future ones are at thelastamericanvagabond.com.
So, we only have a few minutes left. So I just want to talk about some of the, it's just so weird, but I just think it's part of this story, you know, because this is a story of evil. It's a story of pure evil, I think, you know, and of course, I didn't expect to hear this in your conversation with her, but she was talking about seeing all kinds of satanic stuff in their houses. Do you remember that? Her talking about that?
Yeah. She said that she saw a lot of weird symbols and idols and things that she didn't really know what they were at the time. And then years later, she would point out to people she was around and say, oh, I saw that, you know, at Epstein's or at this place I used to work, if she didn't know them really well, you know, and they would be like, oh, well, and she would ask what it was, and they would be like, oh, this is satanic, you know. And one of those was related to like a figure of Baphomet and stuff like that. You know, this is an angle of the story that I haven't investigated really extensively, but it's interesting that she says that, because for anyone that has researched or read, you know, Nick Bryant's excellent book on the Franklin scandal and the subsequent cover up, you know, the Franklin scandal also did involve the sort of ritualistic occult side. So, you know, it is possible, based on what Maria says and other people have said, you know, some things, you know, backing this up, especially regarding some, you know, odd pieces of decor in Ghislaine Maxwell's apartments and homes specifically. You know, this is definitely something that was present, but in terms of, you know, how to explain that, like I said, the focus of my reporting is largely on intelligence ties and Epstein's network, because, you know, things like occultism or Satanism or whatever, it definitely is very hard to get reliable information to investigate, you know, those types of aspects in depth, right? So it's definitely something worth noting, but in terms of, you know, how to explain that or why it was there, I mean, I don't have a good answer for that, unfortunately.
Well, she was also talking about something going on in court, like during her case, after she lost her case. And she said she heard one of the judges say, stop that, that's the reptile's limit.
Lament, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Lament? What the hell is, what was that? I didn't get that at all. Of course, I don't know much about the satanic stuff, but what was that? The reptile?
Well, I think that's just a phrase meant to refer to, you know, sort of like a, like a snake, you know, well, I think it's a metaphor, you know, that it's like a complaint made by someone who's, you know, serpent like, you know, that a lot of these people were really manipulative sociopaths, you know, and oftentimes when snakes and serpents are and reptiles are personified, you know, those are the types of characteristics, right? So I think it was, you know, a reference by the judge to describe, you know, the type of people that were responsible for all of this, you know, Ghislaine and Maxwell among them, who was definitely, you know, psychotic, manipulative, a sociopath that was, you know, a prolific and dangerous sex criminal.
Do you worry about your own security?
No, I don't. Because honestly, I think a lot of people that get into this type of reporting become crippled by fear at some point, or, you know, too uncomfortable, and they don't want to continue to pursue it out of those concerns. And frankly, I think we're at a point in history where those types of concerns, I can't really let those get in my way, because, I mean, this type of behavior has to stop. And the only reason it's been allowed to continue is that the right people didn't continue to speak up when it was necessary. People weren't there to give a voice to people like Maria Farr when she needed to be heard the most, whether that's in government or in media. So, you know, I have no plans to, you know, stop what I'm doing, and I'm not concerned.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for what you do. And thank you so much for talking to us. I really, really appreciate it. And we hope to have you on again.